also the brand has its own personality. So it's not mere Akash. So once you launch a brand, right, it's, and this is like a control thing, but it's not really yours anymore. It's consumers and it has its own journey. And you have to stay true to that DNA. So if you look at some of these like heritage or, you know, legacy brands, the reason why they're so successful and is because they're consistent over decades. And in those codes, especially luxury brands, they probably do it the best. And that makes something timeless and eternal. So I've done a lot of study in luxury brand management, and both of us have worked for LVMH. And I think when you understand that French craftsmanship, that things take time, and the brand has its own personality. It's not necessarily our personal creative vision when we say that. It's just what makes sense for the brand and making
Definitely.
sure they're consistent.
And I think also the fact of, like, I love this term of like conscious capitalism, or the fact that we have purpose, we have stakeholders, we have all these different elements. And I think as we grow the brand, yes, me and Nikki have founded it, and for sure we're gonna be one of the two biggest driving forces of it. But we've got a team now, we've got the customers now, we've got the retailers now, and we need to adapt to their visions of where Fablemans will go together. And ultimately, you know, we will, the brand will outlive us, right? And it might even outlive us quicker than we think. You know, some people sell brands in 5 years. So I think it's important to ensure that it's not heavily dependent on the founders. It can be founder-led, but not founder-reliant, if that makes sense.
You're listening to the Mission Makers Show, a podcast that inspires humans to get into the mindset of success. My name's Farah Nanji, and I'm the founder of a business in the motorsports industry that explores leadership lessons from things like Formula One. I'm also a DJ and music producer in the underground electronic scene, and a public speaker on key topics like resilience, building high-performance teams, overcoming learning difficulties, and stimulating creativity. And to tie it all together, I love writing thought-provoking content as a journalist for these industries which are so unique in themselves. On this show, I'm sitting down with some of the most inspiring and driven people I've met around the world to talk about their processes, their failures, the lessons they've learned, and how they are truly making an impact for this world. Hi guys, and welcome back to episode 5 of the Mission Makers podcast. Today we're joined by Akash and Nikita Mehta, a brother and sister duo who recently launched an incredible plant-based wellness brand which is centered around healing for the hair through ancient Ayurvedic beauty secrets. They've both had a really interesting journey to get to where they are today, from Akash being the youngest ever global digital manager at Dior and a Forbes 30 under 30, as well as a musician who's achieved over 1 million streams on Spotify, to Nikita, who spent her career building luxury fragrances for her family business, who've been involved in designing the scent of Formula One. As a young girl, Nikita's hair would bring the family together because in Indian culture, massaging the head of our elders and youngers are a deep ritual not only for healing, but for bonding, where many a precious tale have been told, and this was the inspiration behind their brand, Fable & Mane. In this episode, we talk about many things, from the challenges of millennial leadership, the delicate balances in a family business, how to capture the fragrance of speed, and of course, how to look after your mane. Just before we begin, if you're interested in watching the video version of this podcast, head over to YouTube and type in Akash and Nikita Mehta, Mission Makers, to see the show. And if you're interested in some really cool rewards like DJ lessons, signed books, and life coaching with me and my teams, head over to www.patreon.com/missionmakers to check out how you can access these exclusive rewards.
Akash and Nikita, thank you so much for joining us today. We're so excited to have you on Mission Makers. How are you both doing today?
Really good. Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much for having us. Very excited to be speaking with you today.
Awesome. So, Akash, I was very interested to know the meaning behind both of your names. And I found out that in Sanskrit, your name means open space and skies, while the name Nikita means abode and the earth, which I think is amazing as a brother and sister dynamic to have those two elements. Do you both feel that the meaning behind your names embody the essences of who you both are and the elements that you might naturally gravitate to?
Yeah, I think for me, if I was to start, I wouldn't know if it's subconsciously, just because I've known my meaning of my name since like I could know the meaning of it. So like sky, for example, it's quite a wide and diverse word. And I think most people would like the word sky. So I've always been like, oh yeah, I'm a sky person. And the color of it, blue, is actually my favorite color. I also like the idea of being in the sky. Traveling is my main passion. Skydiving, for example, one of my favorite activities. If I could do that every day, I would. So yeah, I definitely do connect to the open word of sky.
Awesome. And how about you, Nikita?
I think, you know, it's the first time I've heard somebody say a sibling, like, and it's so true. Like, one is of the sky, one is of the earth. It's such a beautiful, it's great find. And yeah, I'm definitely always been attracted to stuff, you know, humanitarian. So I think maybe that definition of the world and how we can make it a better place ever since I was a child. And working, and not just, you know, not just for humanity, but everyone who shares our life on our planet, you know, our wildlife, our forests. So that's definitely a very earth-oriented, you know, activity and interest of mine. So definitely I would say I'm more of a rooted person. And my brother as well, like he just said, you know, he's an Aquarian, freedom, limitless, all about the air. So yeah, sometimes as they say in Sanskrit, your name reflects your dharma or your soul's purpose. So, yeah, I definitely can see the connection.
And what was the dynamic like growing up? I know that you're the older one, Nikita. Do you feel that you guys are closer now today than when you were younger, or has it always been the same?
Yeah, we're definitely more, I think our dynamic is a lot more mature now. Like the way we communicate, there's a lot more respect for each other from a work point of view as well. We have, you know, our own areas, and I think it's just evolved, you know, like any relationship. But at the same time, he still is my younger brother, so there's always that banter. Like, I love to tease him, you know. He said, I remember when he was like the Forbes 30 under 30 list, I was like, and everyone's like, amazing. I was like, yeah, Akash, but you're still like, I was like, what? You're just like, you know, my nerdy brother who perfect date night is building dinosaur Legos and like all these things. So, but I'm so proud of him. I think, you know, I always say like, what he's achieved, and you know, age is just a number, but I'll always have that, you know, that pride.
But yeah, no, I would say like we're definitely closer than we were younger, but we were very close also growing up, so it's kind of like the perfect definition is we've just evolved into stronger but a upward trajectory relationship. And yeah, I couldn't be happier to have
realize that we need each other in business, you know.
Yeah.
And the value each other brings.
Definitely. I mean, I'm quite involved in our family business, and it is amazing how, you know, when done correctly, the business can really bring you guys closer and evolve your relationships in a completely different way. So similar to me growing up, I know you both went to very academic schools. I think all of our schools that we went to were like the top 10 in the country at the time. So what was your experience of this? What goals did you have for yourself then, and how do you think they match or differ to your present reality today?
Yeah, so I think for me, I definitely have had, I think, three phases of my life, and that's pretty much related to high school, university, and now, you know, working for myself. I grew up very much in that mindset because that's all I knew, kind of from the private schools, etc., that studying was my key to success. And if I didn't get A stars and A's, you know, it'd be game over for me. So I remember I cared so much about just getting the best grades and getting 100%. And that was all I was doing growing up. So after school, I would go into extra tuition, typical Indian family of, you know, let's get on the weekends every morning. Sunday and Saturday, I would have economics tuition, math tuition. So I was just always working and studying. And I think I had the biggest wake up call when I went to study engineering. Not only, I did it because I didn't know really what it was, but I was good at math, I was good at physics. And the logical thing was, let's do engineering for myself, because that's what I wanted to do. Or I thought that's what I wanted to do, because those are what I was getting the best grades in. And then when I went to university after, I really didn't enjoy it. And after the second year, I failed. And that was the biggest fail of my life in that time. And I think coming from someone who would cry if they got less than 90% to then being like, wow, I failed the year. This is it. This is, you know, this is reality now. This is not a drill. Have I wasted the last 20 years of my life choosing a subject that's now set me back and I have to rethink about my whole future? But actually, that was the biggest blessing of my life, because had the year out to think about what's really important, what path is more important, the one society puts, the one studying puts, or the one truly I'll be happy with, you know, pursuing myself. And I then went back to university, finished my engineering degree because I started it and I wanted to finish it. But then I went straight away into an industry that I was passionate about, which was the beauty industry, and put engineering beside me.
Wow. So how did you like kind of find the knowledge to succeed in the beauty industry coming in from it completely blind? Or had you had some exposure growing up to it?
Yeah, no. So our father, like, he's 40 years in the fragrance industry, and we can talk a bit more about that later. But like, he has ingrained into our kind of DNA the power and also the diversity that the beauty industry has. And he used to bring us into meetings. I remember being in a few board meetings or a few kind of external meetings from a young age, sitting on the side, and he used to always be like, "This is my son, this is my daughter, just listening." And at the end of every meeting, he used to always say, whoever was involved, "Speak to my son for 5 minutes, just, you know, I want him to learn." So subconsciously I was being trained without realizing it. But the best thing for me was then during my university career, I was actually pursuing a career in music on the side in tandem. And my producer at the time, to get the record deal, it was with Sony, et cetera, they were saying, "You need to grow your social media following." So I was working so hard to build my social media presence through digital activities and doing it on my, but in turn, didn't realize there's a transferable skills that I could then move into the beauty world and or in a brand and like Estee Lauder. So when I got my first job as the youngest ever social media manager at Estee Lauder Companies when I graduated, was because I actually been training myself for 5-6 years on my own music channel of how to grow in social media. So I think digital at university with the background of my dad led me to actually realizing, oh my God, yes, I've wasted, maybe not wasted, but yes, I spent 4 years doing engineering, but actually I've got experience to actually still do something at a good enough level to not really start from really the beginning.
Definitely. And how about you, Nikita? What was it like for you going to those schools and then kind of matching your present day reality?
Yeah, so, you know, went to an all-girls school, very academic. A lot about getting the A, the 90%. And I felt at uni, what was missing, and what they don't teach you at school, is education of the mind. So then my education now is a lot more holistic, like why we do things, being a bit more conscious and aware, which is definitely, I feel, you know, anyone can cram knowledge in their brain and produce it for an exam. And I think education now needs to be a lot more holistic and creative. But the reason that I think I've got here is because I've went through that whole academic procedure. And I realized I've taken what served me, but I've also realized what didn't serve and what didn't help. And it's definitely provided a great foundation. So I've always been attracted to like innovators, disruptors, entrepreneurs, people carving their own path in life. So, you know, to answer your question, I'm not surprised where I am now or where I will be maybe in 10 years, because I've always known I wanted to work for myself. But and being surrounded by great, you know, female leaders and everything. But I think definitely that part of education of the mind and just awareness and mindfulness was missing.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's a very, obviously it's all of us coming from Indian backgrounds. It's quite a, you know, we've grown up with that kind of holistic way of thinking and kind of adopting those rituals. But I do resonate with what you say about kind of taking what serves you and then kind of just adopting. And I think one of the best things that those kind of places can do is instill discipline in a very different way. But obviously letting go of the attachment of an outcome, I think, is quite important, because it almost feels like when you're in the education system, you're just like living in the constantly in the sphere of the future, and you're not really there to enjoy the present moment. And, you know, we'll never get that time back to be a child and to just do all those things like, hey, you know, go to art class for 2 hours. Well, I'd love to do that now. But, you know, back then, obviously, it was a different mindset. So Nikita, I know that growing up you had a fear of animals, which is just remarkable when you think today of your relationships that you have with animals. How did you overcome this? And does the nature of that incredible change make you hopeful that the obstacles that might be in your way today or in the future could be overcome through the mental strategies you adopted during that time?
Yeah, so honestly, I feel the object that helped me was, I have to thank my brother, because he bought this cute little white puppy from Yorkshire like 10 years ago. And at that time, you know, I literally crossed the road if I saw a dog. I just wouldn't say I was an animal lover, never hug one or touch one or just wasn't my vibe. And then we got this dog, and you know, you care for this other being and on four legs, and you realize, you know, it also has feelings, emotions, and can give so much love and compassion. And I think once you start, you know, just with a pet, it started opening my eyes to the whole world of living in that we're all connected. And when you see other animals being mistreated, but it's still an animal, it just kind of angers you, you know. And I just didn't want to, I always said, I remember watching this documentary of like this, you know, what happens in zoos and wildlife. And I think there's not one animal, unfortunately, on this planet today that's not been abused or exploited for like human entertainment or profit or consumption. And it kind of just led me to also make lifestyle changes, obviously, you know, going plant-based and the values in the company too, and a lot of charitable work we do with animals, but also, I guess, make a commitment to myself that everything I do in my life, and I'll do whatever I can to help them, you know? And then that really just became a part of who I am. And it's not, I wouldn't even say it's because you have to be an animal lover. It's just this understanding, going back to that holistic concept of live and let live, and everything this planet can be in harmony and coexist if we don't interfere, you know, and try not to cage things that are naturally free. And I think that really helped become a bit more compassion. And I think that's like one of the greatest, you know, one of the most grateful things I'm grateful for, basically.
At any point were you afraid, like in the beginning when Akash like brought that dog home?
Yeah. Oh yeah, we were just like, what do we do with it? I had to like go on Google. It was obviously the first few days are really sad because they're not with their mom. So like I was up all night. I had to put like a grandfather clock, so it'd be like the mom's heartbeat, a little like hot water thing. And it wasn't scary because I mean it was a puppy, it was cute, but it's just, I think it's just adapting ourselves to change, right? And the human mind is naturally fearful when anything new comes. So even today, like, I know I'm saying this now, I'm not in the jungle in India, but if a tiger came to me, and I actually had a really close encounter with a lion in Namibia just 2 months ago, where it was literally like not even like, I don't know, less than a meter away. And it's powerful, like just like a lion, just lions roar, and a tiger, if I was with a tiger in India, I don't think, okay, yes, obviously you have to scream and run away, or you know, it will eat you and make noise, but I don't think I would have that fear inside of me, you know? That, and I think that comes from just being at peace with yourself and realizing that everything's connected.
Definitely. If you do have a lion or a tiger in front of you, my best advice is do not run away. Just make yourself bigger, like a sort of like as if like how a gorilla would act, you know, with the chest out. And also start to make some sounds like, you know, hoo, hoo, hoo. It scares, it makes you, if you feel like you're inferior and you crouch and hide, they will pounce and attack like a cat would. So look at the tendencies of a cat. If you end up being in that ever.
That's amazing. On the topic of transitions, Akash, I know that, you know, you're a super talented artist and a singer, and you have, as you alluded, devoted a great amount of time to both growing up. And you did reach 1 million plays on Spotify, so huge congrats to that. Now you focus your time on other pursuits, but I am curious about how the lessons you've learned from the music industry have impacted you, and kind of how the creative energies that you clearly have within you inform your day-to-day.
No, definitely. I think, well, apart from the thing I touched on before, where the digital angle that really helped me kind of from what I was doing with my music career, but actually going into the deeper story of music itself, for me, it was a creative outlook. And I think the suppressing of my school, where, for example, I was really into art and music. I was in orchestra every week, and you know, I was really into this, but I was also very much into my art. And at A-level, I actually put down to do art A-level. But they actually didn't allow me to because it wasn't good for my career choices. So they made me do further maths or, you know, something instead. So having that creativity perhaps suppressed when I was from a young age, I didn't have those outlets. So to rediscover my career in music during university, it really was like my wellness, my meditation. Every time after those busy days in the library and in the lecture room of university and engineering, I would go to the music studio and be lost for a couple of hours. Sometimes it'd be 3 a.m. and I was still singing. And for me, it was like therapy meets my creativity outlet. But it taught me a lot about the mind, about being in tune with yourself. And I think that any true musician today doesn't do it for profit. They don't do it for money. I mean, there's not much money actually in the music industry, sadly enough, but it's more about the fact that you're connecting with individuals around the world, anywhere in the world, to think that someone in Philippines will be listening to my song is incredible, and how they could maybe help them, but also how it's secretly helping myself as I'm putting those words and those emotive feelings into, you know, a song.
Definitely, definitely agree. Was there any point where it was quite tough mentally to kind of get your voice heard, like to a wider audience? Or did it kind of just happen quite organically?
Definitely. I think mainly because as you go into the music industry more, you have different producers, different opinions, and what you might think is the best for you and, you know, your own music is not maybe commercially viable, or is it going to sell? So I think the reason why I lost touch with my music career was two things. One is I really felt I was not being my true authentic self, singing about things that I don't even, never really happened to me, you know, just because it was commercially viable. But also I think the mind play of, it's such a competitive industry, and I kept on always thinking some days I was an incredible singer and some days like I'm average, you know. And I think that self-doubt of how do I get there, and then seeing the industry where you can kind of get average singers be the top of number one chart, so then it becomes less about the music and more about the marketing and the story, and then you know you tick a diversity checkbox. And it was I actually got an audition at Voice, and I got through quite a few rounds, and it was because I was singing a hybrid song of Hindi and English, but I don't even speak Hindi fluently. So I felt so inauthentic, and they wanted me to go down that route. And that's also one of the reasons why I was like, I don't know personally if, I know I can be a successful singer, but I would have to sell things that I know I don't believe in. And I don't want to do that. So I said, let me be my own CEO, my own business. And that's why I chose entrepreneurial route. But music will now always be my own thing that I control, no longer with a record label or producer, but with myself. If I want to release a song to my audience, I'll do it. If I want to sing in the shower, I'm of course going to do it.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, it's you know, sometimes I feel it's quite you know, unbelievable how much you have to do digitally and socially before anybody actually just listens to your music. Like, you kind of have to look a certain way or share things, and it's just like, you know, how hard is it to just go on Spotify or SoundCloud or whatever it is and just press play and just only gravitate to that? But anyway, that's the music industry, and obviously it is quite image obsessed in that way, unfortunately. As the youngest ever global digital manager at Dior, and as Nikita said, Forbes 30 under 30 earlier, how did you ensure that you're always taken quite seriously in business at such a young age, particularly?
So I think I was learning from my mistakes. I wouldn't say mistakes, but I would say the industry-led mistakes. But what I mean by this is, when I was first, my story when I was in Estee Lauder Companies, I started as an intern unpaid. And then 2 months in, I became the youngest ever manager because that social media role came available and I was able to sell myself internally, being like, hang on, I have my own following on social media. I know how to do all this stuff. Let me transfer that to a brand. And at that time, it was quite a new role in the industry in general, five, 6 years ago. But now I remember my first time I signed the contract, the first thing someone said to me was like, you're way too young to be a manager. This is ridiculous. This company's a joke. Like, to my face. And I was like, oh, that was my first like entry into politics in the company. And I was so naive to that. You know, never understood that. I was trained in engineering, you know, we're like coders, and suddenly I'm in this kind of corporate world. And I didn't speak up for myself. I let myself be sort of corporately bullied sometimes. And sometimes, you know, it was up and down. Like, there were days where I was treated really well, but then days where I was like, this is super unfair because this is not about my work. This is about something I can't control, like my age. And I started to realize that age, and I started believing it, but I was like, no, but age is not experience dependent. Like, having, you know, 2 years, or, and not even that, experience is not expertise dependent. So like, having 2 years of experience, I might have a faster rate of absorption of learning or different experiences within those years than someone who's been in the job for 10 years. And at 26 or 25 or 24, doesn't mean that that age means that my rate of learning must be younger because I am of a younger age. So I started to realize I need to speak up for what I think is right. And I said, when I saw my first job at Dior, my first day at Dior, sorry, I said, if my age is mentioned in a meeting that's not related to the quality of work, but just as a kind of a stopping point or like a political point, I quit. And I put that from day one on the table as a sort of protective mechanism that I have a sort of duty to stand by that. And of course it happened, but then every time it happened, I went to my CEO and said, this is not happening. And I actually managed to progress so much in my career. And by the end of it, I had to motivate myself a little bit more to showcase my work to others and say, look, okay, you might have some doubts, fair enough. I'm 20, 25 at the time, and I'm managing a team of people who are older than me, but look at the work. So I went a step further to demonstrate my work is of top quality, but I also wasn't afraid to speak up and protect myself, not just for me, but for the people yet to come, because there are many young, when I say young, it's a spectrum, right? But there are many young entrepreneurs in their career that have the capacity to still deliver, but not be, I don't want them to be jailed by this kind of corporate hierarchical, oh, wait 3 years till you ask for a bonus, wait 5 years till you get promotion, because why are we living in a society that accepts a copy and paste approach and not individualistic, you know, analysis?
Yeah, definitely. Well, there's so much in there that I really resonate with. And at the end of the day, I really believe that, you know, on the one hand, yes, you know, obviously your experience is one thing, but it really a true leader the is about the soft skills that they have. And that is what sets them apart in how they manage teams and everything else. So it's really important. And it doesn't matter how old you are, you know, those, you're not going to be more compassionate by the age of X than you are, you know, Y. It's completely down to your who you are as a person. But it's amazing that you had the courage to stand up and, like you say, pave the way for others, which is obviously so, so, so important. So moving on to Fable and Remain, it's clearly a brand that's deeply rooted around family traditions and spirituality. And when I was reading the founder's fable, I read that as a young girl, Nikki's hair would bring the family together. So I was really intrigued about that. Tell me a little bit more about that, Nikita.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, growing up, I guess like most Indian families, you have a champi time, which is massaging your hair with oils. And our grandma would come from India with these incredible like potent plants and mix them in the kitchen. And I always would go to her after school to say, okay, can you please tell me a story? Which like only if I can give you a oil massage. So that's how it was our time for bonding. And, you know, I'd ask questions like, what was your childhood like growing up? What was your, you know, she'd tell me about all these exotic fruits and ingredients and fables. So it was really a time of, you know, nowadays people are on their phone and like glued to a screen, but it was a real time of authentic storytelling connection. And it even brought generations together, like my mom, my grandma, and me would all be in the same room, you know, and Akash, obviously, you had so many head massages as well, right? With Nani, your favorite time. I clearly remember it. So that's why hair and family time, I think, you know, it just brings people together, and it's such a beautiful way and it's such a beautiful ritual.
Definitely. I think people who are not from our culture, like, they always surprise when you tell them, you know, yeah, like, well, you know, why is your hair so thick, or why is it that? Well, because, you know, we had coconut oil massages, you know, growing up as a child, and I kind of miss those Indian head massages now, you know, and I tease my mum sometimes, like, when are you going to massage my hair, mum? But no, that's amazing, and it's such a cool way of, like, bringing the family together and kind of staying rooted to what bonds you. So talking about families, what kind of values and beliefs did your parents teach you today, that both shapes your characters today?
So I think like if I definitely the whole like well-being, everything to do with that kind of self-care has been really kind of ingrained in us from day one, because our mum really has come from a line of a lot of this kind of spiritual healers. Our grandpa, for example, was, Nikki can say the right terminology, but was traveling around the world and was really a true healer. And people used to come from all over the world to listen to him speak and to have him in his presence. And there's a story that when he passed away, you know, he reached moksha with the enlightenment of the third eye. So he came from a very, very strong background in this way, and also was very close to Osho, if you know who he is. So that was something that from a young age, we were listening always in the car to like Osho. Wasn't the radio, right? It was this. So, and then over time, it kind of embedded itself into loads of different avenues of this kind of area of well-being. So every Sunday, initially we were like, oh, we have to do this. But later we started to love it. Was we had to do family yoga at 10 a.m. and all come downstairs and do yoga. And I remember me and Nikki would be like, oh, can we skip it? But it's funny how me and Nikki today are the ones actually practicing yoga daily and not our parents. So we're like, they've like completely passed the baton, but we've sprinted with it. So yeah, we've been very fortunate where we've been living around this, but also like things like Ayurvedic tools and, you know, tongue scraping and all that kind of stuff and all the ingredients from the kitchen for herbal kind of remedies. We've been growing around this from our whole life. So yeah. Nikki, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of values, like my dad, like definitely the work ethic and hard work, it's definitely shaped my character and people skills. I mean, Akash might have something to say on my people skills, but I feel, I've just watched him in meetings, and when there are issues or anything or any conflict, it's always done in person, never on email or phone. So these little things you definitely pick up from, you know, he came from nothing and he built everything from scratch and the old school way. And there's some like street intelligence, which you just can't learn in books. So that's really been invaluable. And for my mom, it's almost the opposite, but in a great way. It's like celebrate life and don't take things too seriously, which I also think entrepreneurs need, because it should be fun. It's life. It's not.
Definitely. I mean, hopefully when an entrepreneur is starting something, it comes from a passion. It comes from a place of seeing a need for change in a particular system or a place. Of course, it's hard. All the pressures coming together when you wear like 20 different hats when you're an entrepreneur. But when you have your sibling next to you, that's amazing. So how do your personalities complement each other in running the business? And now you've obviously both had, you know, careers prior to being in Fable and Maine. So has that now changed the ways in which you work moving forward, the way that you've kind of developed this dynamic?
Definitely. So we have now very clear kind of skill sets and personality types that really do complement each other. It's always at the perception of the being. So we could always say, look at them and be like, they're so different, we're never going to work together. Or we can actually look at them and be like, hang on, if I'm open to listening and learning and you're open to listening and learning, then we can make these complementary. So that's what we've been doing. And I think it's been really good for me, because we don't tread on each other's toes. We really listen to what our skill sets are and let each other kind of go straight ahead with what we want to do in our own field. But at the same time, we're open to learning from each other. So I have come from a very corporate background. So I know things like the importance of not being late to a meeting or, for example, being organized and how to do email etiquette. Those are things that Nikki perhaps didn't need to do before, because she was working with my father and kind of being more of an entrepreneurial background before. Whereas I maybe am a bit too structured, and Nikki has those creative ideas that are really out of the box, and she finds these suppliers and ideas that I'm like, whoa, like how did you find them? And it's like, I would look the boring way and she would look on Instagram and find these people, you know, like she would be very creative. And I think that has helped the business tenfold. So I am definitely learning from her and she's learning from me, and together, hopefully we're already nearly there. I think we're finding the perfect balance.
Do you still bring in a lot of that creative energy that you have though, like with her?
So I will be honest, I diminish it a little bit, mainly because there's so much work to be done on the financials and the kind of more business hard kind of stuff. So I do focus most of my energy on that. And I feel like sometimes when there's two creative powerhouses, it can really confuse the direction. The Fable and Maine name comes from Nikki. She's the one who really cultivates the idea. I'm the executor. I'm the one making it to market, grow the business. So I think for this business, I've really understood that I want her to feel like she has the full creative control to where it goes. And of course, I will be there presenting my ideas, definitely maybe validating it, saying yes or no. But I think this works for this brand. But I am a very creative individual. So I think I found other ways through my other businesses I work on the side to put that energy in. But yeah, I'm very proud of myself because normally I think I could be quite vocal and be like, no, that's not a good direction. Don't like that logo, because I have my creative opinion. But actually hearing hers and being like, actually, there's no right, you know, both are valid. Let's go with Nikki's. I think it's very important to have that balance.
Well, it's amazing to let go of some of that. When you are a creative, you know, you feel very passionately about something, you know, color or shape or whatever it is. It's amazing that you can let go of some of that. And also, you know, like perhaps the fact that she's your older sister kind of plays into that, to that energy a little bit. I'm not sure. Maybe Nikita would be good for you to kind of.
Yeah, remember who's. No, I just want to add to that, that also the brand has its own personality. So it's not mere Akash. So once you launch a brand, right, it's, and this is like a control thing, but it's not really yours anymore. It's consumers, and it has its own journey. And you have to stay true to that DNA. So if you look at some of these like heritage or, you know, legacy brands, the reason why they're so successful and is because they're consistent over decades. And in those codes, especially luxury brands, they probably do it the best. And that makes something timeless and eternal. So I've done a lot of study in luxury brand management, and both of us have worked for LVMH. And I think when you understand that French craftsmanship, that things take time, and the brand has its own personality. It's not necessarily our personal creative vision when we say that. It's just what makes sense for the brand and making sure they're consistent.
And I think also the fact of, like, I love this term of like conscious capitalism, or the fact that we have different, we have purpose, we have stakeholders, we have all these different elements. And I think as we grow the brand, yes, we've, me and Nikki have founded it, and for sure we're gonna be one of the two biggest driving forces of it, but we've got a team now. We've got the customers now, we've got the retailers now, and we need to adapt to their visions of where Fablemen will go together. And then ultimately, you know, we will, the brand will outlive us, right? And it might even outlive us quicker than we think. You know, some people sell brands in 5 years. So I think it's important to ensure that it's not heavily dependent on the founders. It can be founder led, but not founder reliant. That makes sense.
Hey you, we hope you're enjoying today's episode. We're on a serious mission here to create one of the world's best podcast series, and we'd be so grateful if you could support us in any way by becoming a patron of the show. There's a tier to suit every level, from early bird tiers where you get downloads to all my music with some super cool ninja stickers, to our VIP Mission Maker tiers where you get epic rewards like exclusive footage that never gets aired, the chance to submit questions to our guests with signed copies of books from them, DJ lessons, one-to-one coaching, and a whole load of super cool Ninja and Mission Maker merchandise. You can start supporting us for less than what it costs you to fill up your car for a month by simply heading over to www.patreon.com/missionmakers. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the show.
You guys did launch the brand during the pandemic, if I'm not mistaken, during the first few months. So how did that kind of impact the whole journey, and how did you kind of adapt the launch campaign, you know, with such a crazy time?
Yeah, so we always knew the brand would be very digital first. We knew we wanted to launch in that way. And coming from my digital expertise and the way the market was going, we set a lot of the things from the beginning to be this online omni-channel approach. But of course, we had the Sephora launch, we had the in-store presence, we had some events, we were planning to film a documentary. There's so loads of physical things that unfortunately was initially like, you know, end of because of COVID-19. Unfortunately, we couldn't delay the launch. We didn't obviously expect it to go that quickly, and we just had to roll with it and adapt and be agile. And in a way, we were lucky because we were launching at the beginning of COVID, so we could actually delay and get deposits back and stop things from before we actually pushed the button. So it wasn't like 2 weeks before, it was like literally like on the day like lockdown was happening, like here we go. Wow. But actually it's been the biggest blessing for the business because people are really investing more in self-care, well-being. We can talk to people more if you have, you know, strong storytelling. I think brands that have storytelling at its heart and authenticity in this way can really cut through the needle now on digital and really connect to people no matter where you are in the world and how you talk to them. And also salons are closed, so the logical thing is people are now taking care of their hair at home, and our products are made for at-home hair rituals. So yeah, it's been actually, I would say, maybe a blessing in disguise. But maybe Nikki, do you have any other opinions on that?
No, I completely agree. I think taking that time for rituals, massaging your hair, you know, this is the time for it. So we don't know what it would have been like for us to launch in non-COVID times, you know.
Yeah, no, definitely. And so much of your audience now is completely online. So there's no better time in that regard to capture. I don't, hopefully we'll never be in this time again where so many people are online in this way. But it's great. Yeah, it's acted as a huge catalyst for wellness and developing those rituals. So kind of talking a little bit about Conscious Capital and legacy brands, do you guys feel like they should be doing more when they have such, you know, power and they have the keys to influence such a huge critical mass? And why do you think that it takes such a long time to implement these sustainable initiatives? Is it because they're just too big? What are your guys' kind of opinions on this?
So I have quite a few opinions because I've worked in big companies, and actually one of the reasons why I left these big companies is because of this factor, right? Most of the time there's a three-pronged approach. One is the most obvious is actually they're not built to ever be these kind of brands because they didn't start with a mission. You have these heritage brands that came from heritage, but they didn't actually have the root, the owner didn't necessarily create them for a purpose of giving back. And it's quite difficult sometimes for brands to diversify into that without seeing so marketing led, right? It doesn't come from the root of the brand. So that's one thing. And I think that's why new brands today are really exciting, because they really do have at the heart an authentic story and a reason and a why. Not all, some are about, you know, made just for profit, but the ones that we really connect with today are those kind of brands. That's why we're all interested in these kind of new Sephora-led brands and the giants in the makeup and beauty industry that are like, all right, MAC, I've had this product for ages, but don't really connect to it anymore. There's no one I connect with. The second thing I would say is to do with the fact that it's to do with the leadership team and the in-house team. We forget that these brands are actually not the brand, that people behind it, you know, they're like 20 people, 30 people, 40 people in this room. And if none of them really are leading the conversation, then honestly, you don't really generally have that catalyst to change. And then the third thing I think is because they're scared. They're scared of, you know, if they turn on that button, then they have to actually commit to it. They've got to be, you know, they're open, especially if your brand has got a huge brand presence. It's not a light word. And the minute you say, you know, we're going sustainable, you'll have a lot of questions asked at you. So I think it's about, I understand, but I think if you really want to be the change we want to see, we've got to combat that. We've got to be creative in ways to move forward. We've got to be hiring the right international and even younger people internally to have this kind of voice and to be listened to. And third, we've got to be fearless. We have to be now not worried about what could be, and just do it, because we need to now start really making a difference in the world. Whether you're a beauty brand, you're a race driver, whatever it is, you've got to now think about the planet as well.
Yeah, definitely. It's not an option. And I think you're so right in the fact that, like, in the past, brands, you know, they did what they did and then they dealt with the problems later. Whereas now we're like, okay, this is the problem, and let's root our entire mission around how to navigate around these problems and not create further problems for the, you know, future generations, which is so important. So before Fable and Main, you were both heavily involved in perfumery, and your family's involved with the perfume industry. And what really caught my attention was the fragrance of Formula One. And I think our listeners will be so interested to hear that, you know, what is the sort of the process, the scientific process that goes into curating an alluring scent, such as, you know, adrenaline? How does that kind of work from the initial research stage up until getting it on the shelves?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, Formula One is an incredible brand, and not just for car lovers or for design aesthetics, but I think as a lifestyle, right? It's an experience that people aspire to. And Farah, you're the queen of it as well. So you know, and you live it and breathe it. So it's working. Firstly, it's a license. It's working closely with the team and really understanding the DNA of F1. And from our point of view, we really wanted to, you know, go big on design and working with as Formula One is, and like, this is meant to embody the shape of the car, you mm-hmm. know. Mm-hmm. So when you have a beautiful bottle design, it's all about engineering. You need to make sure every component fits. It's not as simple as, oh, let's just make a bottle, and this is 3D printed too, so mm-hmm. you know, and then making sure all the components come together. And then the first thing is you want to obviously make your juice, your fragrance, and then it goes through a lot of compatibility testing, You do a lot of focus groups. You find the notes. And if you don't have a muse, usually we work with the brand Formula One, and we define the aspects of what the consumer is looking for, who is our target, just your normal how you build a business. But a lot of people think the fragrance process is something, you know, you just put juice in a bottle and it just appears on shelf. It's not, right? It takes months of hard work. That's why a lot of brands can't do it themselves. And a lot of paperwork, registration, you know, the filling time, and then you have to put it in the packaging and then sell it. And there's a lot of behind the scenes. So I mean, maybe Akash, you could take them through, like, you know, each step.
Yeah, just, I mean, really simple. I always love to simplify business because I think people get very confused. And what I like to say is when you were a kid, you went to Build-A-Bear workshop, right? That is how simple business can be. It's about just renaming those steps. And same with building a fragrance. It's really about, there are certain things you can maybe skip, but certain things you cannot. If you don't put the foam in, no matter what you do in the Build-A-Bear, you're not going to have a bear. So the same thing is the same with the fragrance bottle, is forget about the outside. It can always change and it'll be very perceptive. But the main thing is the juice inside. And I think that's where you can't take any shortcuts. You really got to do this typical process, which is finding the nose, discovering the scent. But it's the most exciting thing. It's like trying all these different flavors and seeing what works. But I think today the businesses that really succeed, and what we're, you know, with Formula One is one of my father's new kind of projects, is how much are you bringing in that community, the lovers of Formula One, the potential customers, the lifestyle addicts, and the race car people. And these are the things that we've actually in this fragrance really done a lot of stereotypes and personality tests and A/B testing. And we've got now 5 scents that we're actually really excited, because it really does connect from a functional fragrance, not just a marketing fragrance. So that's, I think, the future of fragrance today, is really connecting that functionality with the lifestyle. And I think that's what we did with Formula One, which is very exciting.
Is it a universal scent, or is it different for men and women?
So it's a universal scent. It's actually very interesting, because even today, I mean, when I was at Dior, a lot of my female colleagues use Dior Homme, you know, like the men fragrance. And I think I started learning about how it's actually very hard now today to, like, I like this word universal scent. I really want to get out of this kind of male and female kind of segment in the aisles and in the retailers and stuff, because, you know, to be honest, as long as you like a scent shouldn't be on a gender, right? Like, I love floral and fruity and sweet, and that usually tends to be the female fragrances. So it's a shame that when I don't actually like the sandalwoods and the ouds and the musks and the very strong scents, I find it very, like, dense and hard for me. So it's a shame I go to the male fragrance and I'm always like, not very excited. And I go to the woman's one and I have to, like, look for that one, which is it's safe, not too much, not like too sweet. But I love the fact that, yeah, these 5 fragrances are very universal, but also universal in the sense of depends on who that person is, because everyone is so, now everyone's got their own unique opinion and are open to, you know, trying new fragrances too.
What are some of the notes? I saw you just smelt the bottle there, Nikita. What are some of the ingredients in the notes?
No, I'm literally thinking, because I don't know the specific notes. I didn't create this perfume, like, or involved in the process, but I've been wearing this for 2 hours right now, and it just really smells like, let me try and find a good explanation.
So we have, like, there's different scents. So there's, like, the Turn One fragrance is actually, like, got, like, I think pink pepper, mandarin, orange, and bergamot as, like, the top notes. And then it's got, like, in the heart notes, there's like some fruity elements of, like, apple and stuff. So there's so many, but
white. Neon white.
Very interesting. But soon on f1fragrances.com we'll be launching a personality test where you'll actually be able to discover your favorite, your best fragrance for you. So that's going to be
it exciting. Smells like money, but in a good way. Like,
however, not I don't know if it smells like money, but that's a perception. That's why I love my fragrance.
But, like, I spray it on my hair because that's where it lasts. But oh, it's incredible. Like, and it's not too much. And it's, like, perfect.
That's interesting. Do you think the feeling of adrenaline and speed comes through that, what you're smelling?
100%. Like, it's got that addictive note. I feel energized. So there is that adrenaline.
And from the science perspective, we wanted to make sure that the fragrances are more than the average long lasting. So like it will basically, you could do a whole race and then at the end still smell.
Well, Formula One drivers sweat a lot.
Yeah.
They lose kilos in races. So I'll be very interested to see how, if you guys get the chance to test that out on one of the drivers. And also just the last question on this is, where is it produced? Are the notes coming from grass in south of France or what's the production line?
Most of the fragrances that we operate in and with the designer parfums, dad's company is from Grasse, exactly as you said.
They have fragrance houses, right?
And usually all the big fragrance houses that we would also work with, like the Robertet's, IFF's, these companies, they also have their own facilities in Grasse, but also offices in New York, London, everywhere. So it's like we can have a middleman to connect to the route. But I was fortunate, and Nikki has as well. We've been to Grasse many times. With Dior, I've been there quite a few times, where Dior owns its own land. It's just the most fascinating place. It's like, if you haven't been to south of France, Grasse, and it's just a short drive from Nice. So if you've been to Cannes, you can go to Grasse. I really encourage everyone to discover fragrance there, and you'll be amazed. It's like better than a theme park if you love fragrance.
What makes it such an amazing place? Is it the ground? Is it some particular things that grow there, the ways that they grow? What makes it the home of perfume in that sense?
It's honestly the family held down traditions of fragrance. Like all the domains and all the land is passed down by generation. They only speak in French. It's not touristic. It's not overly, and that's why these there are only few people that can actually have access to these things, because they don't want to make it, too commercialized. So going to these farms and lands, you're really seeing, like, you're listening to someone talking about the land of rose and how they pick it individually, flower petal by petal, in a basket. And then that basket has been passed down from the three grandmas of the person. And it's like the story is so authentic, and how everyone just does the same thing because it's like a legacy. And I think that also makes you connect more than, it's not just a flower, it's not just a fragrance, there's heart beyond the heart notes, and that's in the actual making of it.
Wow.
And also, just to add to that, the rose de mai, which comes from Grasse, that costs like 1 kilo can cost up to 10,000 or even more pounds, whereas 1 kilo of rose from Turkey is like a couple hundred pounds. So you see the difference in quality from the soil, the way it's picked, and also the time of year. So it's only harvested twice according to the sun. So it's very rare, very precious. And it's a time-tested thing. And then the rose then becomes macerating and becomes the absolute. And then the absolute then gets put into your fragrance at a certain percentage, diluted with alcohol. And that's how you get fragrance.
Well, it is a very scientific process, and as you sort of said, I don't think people realize just how much work goes into creating a fragrance. So thank you so much for sharing that with us. So I'd love to ask you guys, what is the kind of legacy that you both want to build for your family together?
That's a very good question. I think I've always been at this kind of thought process of, our father, as Nikki said, really came from barely anything, starting selling fragrance in stores, and then worked his way up to owning some of the biggest fragrance brands today. We've been very fortunate. Well, we've had his support, his guidance, his mentorship, Faber Lemain is family funded. So we've had it a little bit easier from that perspective, but obviously our hearts and hard work has been the thing that's overcome that. But I really wanna, like, I have this saying, if you're fortunate enough to have a silver spoon, I want to make it a platinum spoon, but for the world. That's our main mission. So I think me and my sister, we both would probably agree to this, is like, we now want to dedicate our lives to giving back. That is our key mission. Like, whether it's through our beauty brand, but also as founders ourselves and the siblings ourselves. So we have Faber Lemain, but we're also working together on our fund, and we're committed initially for big cats, and that's our mission, the wildlife protection. But God, who knows what will come in the future. We want to expand it to those different areas. But that's, I think, our main passion, beyond just growing the businesses consistently. But Nikki, what's your thought?
No, I completely agree. It wasn't to start business to fulfill a material desire. It was really for our planet and how can we leave it more beautiful, you know, and that can be a legacy. I think it's not just our thing. It should be every individual's on this planet in whatever capacity they can to leave this planet more beautiful. You know, we are in beauty, but I think beauty is also today. It's about strength, compassion, equal opportunities. You know, it's not just the external old mindsets of what beautiful is. It comes from within. So I think a legacy of awareness of our true selves, and with Fable and Maine, help people, you know, bringing that Indian culture to the world with fables that fascinate. So yeah,
that's amazing. I definitely agree. I think, you know, we all have a duty to leave this world in a better place than we found it, and right now it's not in such a good place, so there's a lot of work to be done. So I know that you have you're both very much obviously, as we've discussed, a lot into spirituality, and I know, Nikki, that you've spent a lot of time with various teachers such as Deepak Chopra and stuff. So this could be a long question, but in just a brief nutshell, can you share kind of what writings and teachers have had the greatest effects on your paths? And do you have any desires to kind of go down sharing some of that spiritual knowledge on a deeper way someday?
I'd absolutely love to. I think I'm still on this journey, and I feel once you've experienced something, then you're in a position to share. Yeah. I think there are a lot of people, especially on social media today, give a lot of advice. It's like, have you really experienced it? Like, what do you really know about the ego? But I definitely can, so grateful for all the past teachers. I mean, everyone from the Buddha to Krishnamurti to Eckhart Tolle to, you know, Osho. There's so many people on The Unearthed Soul by Michael Singer that have just helped on every, you know, it says when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. So all my teachers have been books, and I've learned a lot, and it's one thing to understand something, but it's another thing to apply it and practice it and live it. Correct. So definitely this concept of, you know, freedom, surrender, and how it's so different, the freedom in the West, freedom in the East, is something very significant, I think, and has really helped me evolve as a person.
Talk to me more about freedom of the West and the East, and the kind of maybe the juxtapositions in that.
There is, I think, freedom in the West, and what we've been brought up is, if you want something in life, you go get it. It's a bit more an hedonism, where I, like, you know, it's for ourselves. We're just thinking of me, and you kind of control your surroundings. It's like, I'm gonna go get that. This is my life. I control it, and I deserve it when I want it, what I want, right? Whereas freedom in the East is all about liberation. So how are we free? This concept of anatta in Buddhism, of no self, and moksha or nirvana, liberation from all the worldly desires, but also liberation from ourself, which is almost like the opposite, right? It's not, it's you don't go out and get something, you just surrender and be in the state of let go and let things come to you at its own divine timing. Because if you are going against the river and going against the flow, then conflict starts to happen. And I think that's a struggle with a lot of entrepreneurs today as well. That's why we always need to balance letting go, going with the flow, surrender and acceptance, because we always try to control our situations, which works in business and with ambition. So if you're ambitious and you have an intention that I want to make a $6 business, like a six-figure business, you know, this is what I have to do, this is my business plan, and this is the steps, you most likely will get there. But it's a complete opposite in your spiritual world and inner self, because you have to let go and you shed and detach. It's a very interesting balance, I think, when you're on a spiritual journey and then also an outwardly ambitious journey. You know, this balance between letting go and the state of nothingness, and then achievement and success as society defines it.
Yeah, I think it's so true. And I think to find your true spiritual self, and to really adopt those practices is about letting go of attachment to the world, and finding ways to be, you know, in this planet and transcending this planet, but without seeking the need to kind of enhance your sense of self, essentially, what you've very much kind of said there. talking about letting go of the ego, do you think that humanity is reaching the end of the evolutionary stage of ego? Do you think we're at that point yet in our lifetime?
Do you think, reason being what's happening in the planet, and we're all a little bit more realizing our old ways are not working? I definitely think it's about time. I mean, how humanity needs a big awakening and a wake-up call. I think that's happening, and we have to be in the now and release our old ways. But in terms of our ego, I think it's, the ego is very cunning. So even if it thinks like you have no ego, it's still your ego speaking. So the only way to access no ego is through meditation. You know, whatever your form of meditation is, mine's through breath work, and realizing and just being in that state of no mind. And you're witnessing, you're almost observing your thoughts and your ego, and then it just releases, and then you can get that. You know, I know Farah, you do Kundalini yoga, that there's so many meditations and different ways to experience that inner state of bliss and oneness, and eternity, which is our true selves. So for me personally, it's just been reminding myself that our mind is not something we're born with, in the sense like this ego, it's been created. And every time I have this little, because we all have little, like, okay, something annoys you, or something, you know, like, oh, why is this happening to me? Or this shouldn't be happening, or taking things personally. I'll just check in with myself and say, this is not, you can control your mind almost. So, but it's hard work, and not everybody wants to do that. And it's a lot, I think Russell Brand said, you know, ego is just an invitation, or pain is just an invitation of the ego. It's just an awareness of ego, and we have to de-shed it. So
I would also say, like, on a devil's advocate perspective, like, I think it's about redefining what we mean by ego, because if you can have healthy and unhealthy ego, and at the end of the day, ego is part of your neuropsychological system. So it's so important to understand that it does have some science behind it, that it protects you. It's important to have an ego. But it's about, are we talking about a productive and healthy ego, or are we talking about unproductive and unhealthy ego? And how do we balance that? Because as humans, we would have both, and they can come at different times or at the same time. But yeah, I think I would love the society to get into more of a healthy ego and less of an unhealthy ego.
Well, I don't think the ego is ever healthy. I feel like it causes miserable. But I think what you're saying, Akash, is valid, that ego sometimes is confused with self-love. You know, like putting yourself first, oh, she has a big ego or something, but actually you have to put yourself first to take care of other people, you know. But then that, there's a fine line and the balance, you know, it's like the razor's edge and becoming too in vanity or narcissism, and then you know, what you're really doing for yourself. So I think it's like all words in life, love, freedom, ego, they've all been defined, and everyone has a different definition of it.
So true. Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot in what you say about, in a way, like, you need to have self-confidence, but then you don't want to act with ego, you know, in your actions, and you don't ultimately want your mind to be dictating your thoughts, which is, I think, what Michael Singer talks a lot about in Untethered Soul, is that, you know, observing your thoughts but not having attachment to them, and not acting upon them. But I also think that a lot of the problems in this is that it really stems from childhood, and, you know, the schooling system and the ways that we have been brought up to just be in that constant state of future, and we never really get to that point, because all we have now is present moment, and that's it. So it's very interesting talking to you guys about this, and I'd also like to know what some of your non-negotiable habits are to kind of adopt the mindset of impact.
Nikki, do you want to start?
So the mindset of impact, what does that exactly mean? Like, how?
So, like, let's say just setting yourself up to succeed every day, like, you know, taking care of yourself. What are the, I know that Nikita, you have loads of things that you do.
But yeah, the best top three, I do a lot of breath work and inner work. Like, I think it just helps, especially in this Zoom culture today. You know, just to calm the mind and be more in the body. So any exercise, any movement basically will really help that, get your energy flowing, number one. Number two, for impact in terms of with other people and using your voice, I think you should always listen more than you speak, which is more of a mental thing. Because I think sometimes people, you know, always want to say and think they know best, but actually you learn more by listening. And the third would be, well, I guess it's just more what I do to de-stress, because I think to be a healthy leader, you have to be, you know, very calm within and allow things to change with the constant nature of business and everyday things change. So I do a lot of, you know, it's ironic, but it's true. I do a lot of head massage and gua sha on my face and like with oils, and it just really helps de-stress, because our crown chakra, we have, you know, different energy points in our body, but the one right here is linked where we store all the stress and tension. So just by touching it or massaging it, and if you know, even a few minutes every day, it really helps relax our whole nervous system, our vagus nerve, which is linked to so many other inflammations. And I think it can really just self-regulate the body, because we put too much pressure on our brain and we're like literally forgetting the rest of our body, you know?
Yeah. I think for me, I have a lot of habits, but in terms of the non-negotiable ones, the ones that like will not change every day, they're kind of geared around four main criteria of my being. So the one is about work, and that's about creating a to-do list every day. And I call them the realistic to-do list. I write on a piece of paper what like I'm going to be achieving today, and kind of like what are the non-negotiable things I have to do and what things I would like to achieve. That is kind of like a refresh. Every morning with my coffee, I write that down. I look at that every day and I'm like, cool, 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 cool. I might add to it, but that's my non-negotiable for work. My second thing I do from a fitness perspective is I need to do at least half an hour of something a day, whether it's going for a run, Peloton or yoga, whatever. I have to do 30 minutes and I measure it on my Strava. If I don't do it, I can't. So even if I sometimes at 1 a.m. I'm about to sleep, I'll still do it because I need to do that. It's non-negotiable. Healthy or not, it's non-negotiable. And the third thing, well, the four things. The third thing is about my mind. So it's really about just kind of making sure that I have that 30 or 20 minutes or 10 minutes of a micro meditation. So it might be 5 minutes some days, it might be 30 minutes other days, it might be even 1 minute some days. But I try to do a little bit of just breathing, sitting, closing my eyes in that moment and just trying to relax. And usually I do it in between Zoom calls because it gives me a sense of escapism. And my last thing that I personally think is so important is to have for sure something fun in the day, like something to look forward to every single day. So tomorrow, I plan it the day before and I'm like, tomorrow I'm going to do a bit of Lego, or tomorrow I'm going to meet a friend, or tomorrow I'm going to play Catan online. You know, like I make sure I need to do something like that, especially during COVID and lockdown. Like we need to have some exciting moments every day, because every day we live, it'll be a shame to not have a moment of joy that's for you, not for work, not for your body, you know, just for you.
100%. Thank you guys for sharing that with us. So we're moving on to the audience Q&A section of our interview. We've had two questions come in for you both, and so we'll give this one to Akash first. It comes in from Ali, and he says that businesses can ultimately be stronger when family is involved, as you both have clearly shown us. However, it's incredibly hard not to talk about the business at home. So how do you keep these boundaries between each other to make sure that, you know, there's a healthy line there, and the conflict can kind of be minimized?
I think it's kind of, there's a few ways. The first is it is very difficult, and we do it a lot. But I think also, because when we're not with each other, we talk all about work. It's kind of like in our DNA or in our kind of mindset that when we meet, we're like, I don't want to talk about work right now. Let's just like, this is the one moment where we don't need to talk about work, which just sounds so counterintuitive, because you're like, well, surely when you're together, that's when the most work gets done. But, you know, because of COVID and because we've been growing the business away, I started in Paris, she was in London. Then now I live in my London flat. She lives in my family home. We've always been away building this brand. So we've actually adopted that work ethic of we can just work like this. And actually that's what helps us succeed, because we're not in our face all the time. You know, I can like literally hang up and then have a 3 hour break from Nikki today, you know? And those are really important. And I think the second thing is about, we also like, don't want to like, you know, like annoy our parents a bit and stuff like that, because it can be a little bit lot. Cause my, especially with my mom, because my dad, I talk to him a lot about with work, and I talk about Nikki. And then it's after a while, it's like, I don't want to feel like all we talk about is like me, Nikki, and Dad about work, and Mum's like, okay, dude, guys, come on, like, life is not all about work. So she's actually a little discipline maker. She, when we do that, she's like, guys, come on, no work on the table, no work on the dinner table, and that actually helps us quite a bit, I think.
Awesome. Okay, Nikita, what is your typical hair care routine, and what are some of the yoga poses you do to strengthen your mane?
Oh, I love that. So, typical hair care routine, I'll oil my hair once a week without fail, usually overnight, you know, massage it in, and I'll like braid it or put a turban on so it doesn't like affect the pillowcase. And then I'll wash it, just like a quick rinse, then shampoo only like the top, like a clarifying shampoo just like on the top. And the Holy Root shampoo is super hydrating of Fable and Mane. And then I'll either condition or I'll put a mask, like for extra nourishment, because I have like really dry, frizzy hair. But what I really find like the most effective with hair health is like the before and after ritual. So like oiling before shampoo, and then the aftercare is like, you should never, you know, comb your hair when it's so wet, not with a brush, use like a wooden comb or, you know, something wide toothed. And also never wrap your hair, especially when it's wet, in a towel. You can get like a specific hair turban, because that's when the most breakage happens. We don't realize that. We always think, oh, it's like, oh my God, I've hair fall in the shower. And we only think of the shower, but it's the whole ritual. It's not just what products you use, it's how you take care of it. So that's what I do. I always wash my hair less as well, probably once, maybe twice a week. So that definitely helps. Because our scalp produces natural oils, and scalp is skin, and you just have to let it breathe. You can't keep putting products on it. And why oil is so great, it's really hydrating. So just how water is so good for our skin, oil is amazing for our scalp. And when you have a hydrated, healthy scalp, it's going to lead also to natural hair growth. So
any particular, like, is it coconut oil or what ingredients?
Amla oil is fantastic. It's the highest form of vitamin C. There's ringraj, castor oil is fantastic for thicker looking hair, ashwagandha for strengthening your scalp, and coconut's definitely incredible as a sesame. Coconut is the most widely used, especially in southern India, because it's cooling. So if you are someone with a lot of like heat in your body, you'd want to use cooling herbs. But I'm a vata type in Ayurveda, which is I'm always very cold, so I need a lot of heating herbs, and the massage really helps that too. But most of these Indian herbs are really smart, so they kind of adapt to your scalp. And neem is fantastic too if you've got itchy, flaky, dry scalp as well. I love these Indian ingredients. And then for yoga, anything with an inversion, you know, Akash, you probably can pronounce the names better than I can, but there's a lot of breath work, Kapalbhati, which really helps circulation, downward dog, shoulder headstands, anything that helps. We're standing like straight, so there's not much blood flow to our brain right now. So naturally inversion is going to help, and that will help stimulate circulation, which will help with hair.
Fantastic. Well, that's a great question from Jessica. So thank you. And thanks for the tips, Nikki. So moving into our last section, it's our quick fire round, 60 seconds, no more than 60 seconds on each question. So we will start with you, Nikki. Describe Akash in 3 words.
Ambitious, tolerant, and dare I say it, cool.
Okay, fair play. We're gonna give you the same question, Akash, just to make it fair. So describe Nikki in 3 words.
Creative, ambitious, and kind-hearted, just kind of one word, right?
Okay, awesome. Nikki, you've mentioned that you love books, so I'm curious, are you reading anything right now, or can you give our listeners any recommendations of a great book?
Yeah, I'm reading Change Your Thoughts, Change Your Life by Wayne Dyer. So literally everything we spoke about today in one book. It's based on the Tao Te Ching, which I think is a must read for anyone.
Fantastic.
Also read How I Built This by Guy Raz recently. It's really great. It's all about founders and how, you know, based on his podcast as well. But really, really insightful to see different people's journeys. And I learn a lot from that.
Awesome, awesome. I'm gonna go read that one. What's something you both like to do the old-fashioned way?
Nikki, go first.
I'm not big on like texts and stuff. So this is more like probably my personal life, but I like to write like letters. Like nobody does posts anymore. So I do a lot of writing, like even thank you cards, instead of just sending like, you know, an email or a text, which I find a bit more impersonal.
Nice.
I think for me, it's kind of like, going back to the kind of to-do list and daily managing, I like to just write it down on a piece of paper. I'm not very good at putting all these like ideas on like the calendars and keep it all digital. Even though I'm a very digital person, that's the thing. I just like to see it physically and write it. There are certain things you get from writing down on an actual physical thing, I think is quite important. But also the idea of like, once it's done, I scrunch it up and recycle it. You know, like I love the idea of like, it's done, not still on my emails somewhere.
Yeah, definitely. Or just taking a pen and literally just ticking something is so
exactly.
satisfying.
Crossing it over in different colors and
yeah, definitely. Nice. So how do you both like to discover your wild?
Oh, I love that. Mind through dance easily, like anything that helps me activate, unleash your inner tiger, you know. I think as women as well, we've been repressed in terms of like just generations of what we can't do. So it's really important to access that wildly, you know, feminine and divine force of our being too. And I really, really feel alive and, you know, free through dance, like just movement.
Awesome.
For me, it's kind of like very obvious, but it's whenever I'm in nature and whenever I'm connected to the soil, the earth, or animals, especially like anytime I'm in Africa, which I try to go once a year. I was in last December and Namibia the year before in Kenya. When I'm actually in the wild itself, in the safari, is when I'm the most connected to my own wildness.
There's something very special about sunrises in the African plains.
I mean, that's probably actually it. You hit the nail on the head. It's a really that kind of cycle of being with the world as the world wakes up, and like, you know, being out on the open 5 a.m. in the land. It's like, you know, that's what safaris are. So yeah.
100%. Okay, and final question: what are you both most grateful for this month?
This month, I'm most grateful for my new place I'm moving into. It's nice to have a new home. For sure.
Nice.
For me, it's definitely a mindset. I think I'm really grateful for being more present. Like, it sounds weird because we should always be in the now, but this month I just feel at peace with a lot of things. So I'm very grateful for that.
Very good. Well, guys, thank you so much for joining us today on Mission Makers. We've loved having you on the show. You guys have shared some amazing tips. So thank you both so much for your time. And I am definitely going to have to try some Fable and Mane in the hair of my own rituals as well.
Amazing. Well, thanks so much for having us and for such a very inspiring discussion. Thank you.
Thank you.
It was incredible catching up with Nikki and Akash. I feel like we could have talked for hours, and I absolutely love how they've centered spirituality and protection of the planet around their brands and the individual journeys that they've both been through to get to this point. Leadership in a family business or as a millennial is tough, and Formula One actually really demonstrates this a lot. Case in point, right now on the grid, there's a huge difference in ages between the drivers, and a lot of the younger ones do come from a family background in motorsport. And they're all received very, very differently, from Lance Stroll to Mick Schumacher or even Carlos Sainz. It's really interesting observing how these guys are handling that under such a global lens of scrutiny, and also seeing the older generation like Hamilton defend with everything he's got against the younger and incredibly hungry Max Verstappen. So talking about F1, we've got some amazing guests coming on the show this season, so be sure to subscribe to the show on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, and wherever else you listen to your podcasts. Thank you again for listening and for writing in. We love hearing what you guys are thinking of the show, so do feel free to reach out to us at Mission Makers or at dj.n1nja on Instagram. And if you're interested in supporting the show and getting some really cool rewards like DJ lessons and seeing some of the episodes ahead of time, then don't forget to visit www.patreon.com/missionmakers.